Hello. Welcome to Discussions with DPIC. I'm Robert Dunham, the Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Ohio last carried out an execution in January 2014, and it didn't go well. With the state using an untested combination of execution drugs, witnesses reported that Dennis McGuire snorted, choked, and struggled for 25 minutes, arching his back against the restraints that held him down and writhing in apparent pain until he died. Shortly afterwards, a task force formed by the Ohio Supreme Court to review the administration of Ohio's death penalty system completed a 2.5-year study, and it issued detailed reports highly critical of the state's death penalty. It recommended 56 reforms to prevent wrongful convictions and to prevent unfair and arbitrary death sentences. After McGuire's execution, Ohio's death row prisoners filed a challenge to the state's execution process that has put executions on hold for 3.5 years. But now, with virtually no reforms in place, Ohio has scheduled 27 executions between this coming week, July 25th, and the end of 2020. Joining us today is Michael Benza, a veteran capital defense lawyer and professor of criminal and death penalty law at the Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Mr. Benza spent 4 years in the Capital Defense Unit of the Ohio Public Defender's Office and has argued death penalty appeals in all of Ohio's state and federal courts and in the U.S. Supreme Court. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start kind of at the beginning. What's up with Ohio?
Well, Ohio is trying to restart the machinery of death that has been on hold for the last 3 years because of the state's inability to carry out an execution in the way in which the state says it should go forward. It's really a matter over the last 3 years that the state's machine of carrying out the execution, that is the way they kill somebody, has just failed, both to accomplish the goal of carrying out the execution, but then also to come up with a way to carry out executions that the state can actually do.
Well, let's start with the failure to carry out executions properly. Dennis McGuire is touted as one of the classic examples of a botched execution in the United States. What happened to him?
Visibly, it did not go the way the state of Ohio said it was going to go. And it's those appearances that things are happening incorrectly that lead to the conclusion that something else besides what the state says happened is really what's going on.
Now, in Dennis McGuire's case, the state used a drug called midazolam. It takes 25 minutes. He appears to be struggling throughout that entire process and exhibiting all the signs that the people who were criticizing the use of midazolam warned about. What did the prisoners do after that to try to stop Ohio from continuing to execute them in that way?
So we, in Ohio, we have actually had ongoing lethal injection litigation. The state has simply been changing the protocol every time one of these issues comes up with the way that they are carrying them out. So much so even that Judge Frost, who had the initial lethal injection litigation until he retired, acknowledged in one of the many orders that literally what the state is doing is it's coming into the court, telling the judge the state will carry things out this way, and then carrying out the execution in a completely different way. And so the inmates really have been sort of filling in the litigation based on what the state did the last time. And the response from the state is, well, we've changed it, so you got to start all over again.
And didn't the state at some point say, well, we're not going to use midazolam anymore? The evidence is pretty strong that it doesn't work. We won't use it, and we're not going to use a paralytic drug either.
Yes, the state has, in a number of different instances, told the federal courts that it is abandoning one method of execution, changing to a different method, and even at one point said we would never go back to using this type of a drug. And I know that Judge Frost was very frustrated with some of that because the state would make these representations in all sorts of areas during the course of the litigation and then would just change. And that's sort of a normal pattern here for the Department of Corrections to say, well, this is how we'll do it, and then they don't do it that way.
There were three prisoners who were initially scheduled for execution. At least, well, there were more who were scheduled, but there were three who were facing imminent execution. Ronald Phillips is one of them, and he's sort of the lead defendant that the litigation is based on. Now, they initially challenge the use of midazolam. And Ohio, after botching the McGuire execution, says they aren't going to use it. But there's an evidentiary hearing, a long one, that's held in the district court. And the district court makes a couple of decisions. One finds some facts about midazolam and the paralytic drug, and it also finds some facts about what Ohio itself has said, and will they be permitted to use drugs in the future? What did the court say?
So the district court, or the magistrate judge who had the evidentiary hearing regarding the use of midazolam itself, found that the plaintiffs in the case, which are the inmates, had shown that there was a substantial likelihood that the execution would violate the Eighth Amendment using midazolam. And that's because Ohio has sort of come full circle with our protocol. We are now back to a three-drug cocktail, which has been sort of a problem for a number of different reasons. The first drug that they give is the midazolam, which is supposed to anesthetize the inmate so that the inmate doesn't feel anything. They then give a second drug that paralyzes the inmate. And then they give a third drug that is actually the drug that kills the inmate. Everybody agrees that the second two drugs in and of themselves would violate the Eighth Amendment, that they would be torture to kill somebody using those two drugs, even together, or singularly or together, would violate the Eighth Amendment. So what the state has done is said, well, we're going to give them this huge dose of midazolam, which should anesthetize the inmate so he doesn't feel the pain of the two second drugs. Of course, the second drug doesn't do anything except paralyze the inmate, so if he's suffering, he can't do anything about it. There was an old movie a couple of years ago with Harrison Ford where he killed his first wife by using this type of drug. He gave it to her, paralyzed her. She's still alive, but she can't move, and then he drowns her. And then, of course, by the time they recover the body, you can't prove that she had this drug. That's what the state's doing. They are using this drug to hide any reaction that the inmate might have to the third drug because he's not properly anesthetized by the midazolam. And the medical question that the judge found was that there's simply no evidence at all that the midazolam is going to actually operate the way that the state says it will, that is, that the inmate would not feel any pain. And quite frankly, it's because no medical professional uses midazolam the way the state wants to use it.
So the scientists, the medical professionals who testified, talked about how midazolam doesn't put you under in the sense that it renders you incapable of feeling the pain. And if it's used, there was a substantial probability that the prisoner would experience severe and intense pain.
Correct. Right. Now, what the state's experts said is they sort of disagreed in that final conclusion. And their position was, well, there's not enough evidence to say that, yes, the inmate would feel the pain. I mean, we don't even know, for example, whether the amount of drugs that they're giving, I know that's a big focus for the state and was a big focus in the Sixth Circuit, where they're going to get 500 milligrams of this drug. Well, there's evidence that after a certain point, no matter how much of the drug you give, you get no more effect. And so you're giving them drugs, you're giving them a large amount of the drug, but at a certain amount, the drug just doesn't do anything more than what it's already doing.
Let's move away from the question of how the executions are being are supposed to be carried out in Ohio, and more to the question of what's the risk. earlier this week, and we're recording this on Thursday, July 20th, earlier this week in Ohio, there was a coalition of people who were expressing opposition to the state restarting executions. And they included the chairman of the Ohio task force that we referenced earlier, two former state attorney generals, corrections officials, death row exonerees, and religious figures. What are they complaining about? Why are they saying Ohio should not start up executions?
I think the primary movement behind this growing public questioning about the validity of capital punishment is really the fact that the task force brought to light the practices and the impact of capital punishment in a way that people outside of the death penalty litigation just didn't see. It's easy to look at a single execution and say, oh, that's okay, that person deserved to die, this was right, this was fair, this was whatever. But when the task force really sat down and looked at what Ohio was doing and how the process worked, that's what really drove people who, in many cases, had not only been supporters of capital punishment, but in the position of Jim Petro and Lee Fisher, former Ohio attorney generals, arguing for and carrying out executions, to come back and really question the way Ohio's criminal justice system treats these cases. We have race disparities, we have economic disparities, we have geographic disparities. All of these things lead to a system in which it really seems to come down to not whether or not a particular crime is something that is worthy of capital punishment, but really a factor of where you commit the crime, who the victim is, who the defendant is, that leads to these decisions in a way that our criminal justice system isn't supposed to do.
So what's been done about that?
Fortunately, absolutely nothing. The task force outlined 72 or so different types of recommendations that they had. And of those recommendations for improving the system, not a single one of any magnitude has been implemented. In fact, the only one that has gotten sort of any attention in our General Assembly is the issue of executing people with severe mental illness. And that at least has had a bill that is introduced and in the committees, but nothing else is even on the General Assembly's radar to start addressing these various problems within capital punishment.
Then why is Ohio attempting to move forward with executions if there's been this task force report recommending numerous reforms and nothing's changed?
Well, I think there's a number of different factors. Even though the task force made the recommendations for how to improve the system, the state and the federal courts have not done anything to hold that Ohio's system is actually failing. And so I think you have an institutional reluctance to take on the legislative process of changing the system when the courts are saying you can still carry out executions. I think the General Assembly has learned over time that when they make changes to the death penalty system, it simply leads to more litigation over the changes that were made. And so I think you have this institutional incentive to do nothing. As long as they're getting what the institution wants, what the legislature wants, and what the state wants, and that is to carry out executions. I think also you have some of the political players, most notably the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association, coming down to the General Assembly and saying everything is just fine. There's nothing wrong with our system. Let it go the way that it is. Trust us, we'll make it work right. And the General Assembly is doing that.
Now, recently, there were hearings in the Ohio General Assembly on the question of exempting individuals with severe mental illness from the death penalty. And the prosecutors objected to that as well.
Yes. Yes. The position of the prosecutors throughout the task force process was one of, you know, there's no reason to even have the task force. Everything is just fine. And then anytime there were discussions about making changes, the prosecutors opposed almost unilaterally every question or suggestion to make changes. Their current objection to the issue of mental illness is that that's already protected in our death penalty statute, and that people with severe mental illness will never be executed. And of course, that's just not true. Mental illness does not bar the execution of people. What Ohio law does is tell the jury that it can consider a defendant's mental illness as a reason not to execute him, but it does not unilaterally present the execution. Much like the Supreme Court declared that you are categorically prevented from executing people under the age of 18 at the time of the crime or people with mental retardation, our statute doesn't prohibit mentally ill people from being executed.
Well, that brings up another very interesting question, I think, which is that you have these 27 people who are set for execution. Let's say that mental illness was a question to be presented to the jury. Are there any things that have changed in Ohio since some of these people were sentenced to death that might be a reason why they should not be executed?
Of changes. For many of the people who have currently scheduled execution dates, and we have 27 executions scheduled over the next 3.5 or 4 years, a huge number of these guys were sentenced, and they're all men, were all sentenced, as far as I can recall looking at the people who have dates, before Ohio adopted life without parole as a sentencing option. And certainly all of them were sentenced to death, even if life without parole was an option for them, at a time in which the only way a prosecutor could try to get life without parole was to also seek the death penalty. And so that's a major change. We don't know what the juries in these cases would have done if they had been told that an option at sentencing was life without parole, which means that the inmate will never get out absent the governor granting clemency. That simply was not an option for them. In fact, in these cases, the prosecutors would repeatedly argue that the life sentencing options that were available were that the inmate would get out. He would be paroled at 20 years, or he would be paroled at 30 years, and would then argue the only way to ensure that he doesn't get out is to execute him. Well, life without parole eliminates that argument to the jury that this inmate will never get out.
But if you're severely mentally ill, Michael, if you're severely mentally ill and the prosecutor tells the jury that if you don't sentence this person to death, there's a chance that he's going to get out, isn't that going to turn what should be a reason for life into a reason for death?
Absolutely. It's the same thing that prosecutors would argue when it came to the issue of mental retardation. They would take this reason not to execute somebody, that this person had some mental capacity issue or a mental illness issue that maybe says we shouldn't execute them, and they would turn it around and say that it's actually a reason to execute them, because if he's mentally ill now, he's going to go to prison, he won't get treatment, he'll be released, the mental illness will still be there, and he'll kill again. And that argument is in fact carrying the day in many of these cases, that the jury is afraid of the people they sentence to death, and they're afraid of people with mental illness. And therefore, they use that not as a reason to give that person a life sentence, but as a reason to give them death.
So let's fast forward now to today. We've got 27 people. They're facing execution over the next couple of years. And most of them have been tried in a process that didn't give the jury a full opportunity or a fair opportunity to consider whether they should live or die. How does that play out in the clemency process?
Unfortunately, it does not seem to be a huge factor for either the governor or for the clemency board. Occasionally, the board, when they're reviewing a clemency application, will talk about the inability of the jury to consider certain types of evidence as a reason to look at a case and say maybe clemency is deserving in this case. But it really doesn't focus on the fact that if this case was tried today, the sentencing option of life without parole might have made a difference. The clemency board really does not focus on that issue unless it finds some other reason to question the validity of the jury's decision. And that means something like the defense lawyers didn't present certain types of evidence, or there are certain statements from the victims and family who say that they want a different sentence, or some questions even about innocence. We've had a couple of cases where the clemency decision was to not execute the defendant but keep them in prison for periods of time because maybe they were innocent. But again, that didn't focus on the jury sentencing options at the time.
Is the governor bound by what the pardons board says?
No. The law in Ohio is that the governor must have the report and the recommendations of the board, but the governor is free to make whatever decision the governor chooses to make. He can go against the decision. He can follow it. He can do it for reasons that are different than what the board found. All he has to do is get the report.
So is it anticipated that during the clemency process, the men who are scheduled to be executed are going to argue to the governor that the system that was in place when they were sentenced to death is very different from what it is now, and it's out of step from the way the death penalty is administered across the United States, and ask him to make a determination about whether it's a jury reasonably would have spared the defendant's life if they knew that he would never get out and return to the streets?
Having had clients executed and having gone through the clemency process, that is a part of every clemency presentation. One of the things that is done for every defendant in clemency, this is all of those that I've represented and those that I've gone to the hearings on, there is a comparison of that particular defendant's crime and sentencing process and everything to current cases or other cases that are similar, and trying to show the board that this case isn't the type of case that the death penalty is supposed to be for, because there's a bunch of these other cases that are worse or as bad, and different things led to those defendants getting life, whether it's better lawyers or the availability of life without parole. You try to explain to the clemency board, and then through that to the governor, that this case isn't a death case other than the fact that this particular defendant in this particular situation got death. But that's not what everybody else is getting.
So here we are. This is Thursday, the week before the scheduled execution. The prisoners have won in the district court. The district court says that the method of execution Ohio wants to use is unconstitutional. Ohio appeals that to the federal appeals court, and the prisoners win again. Then Ohio appeals that to the full court of appeals, what's called the en banc court of appeals, and a divided court overturns the panel and overturns the findings of the district court and allows the executions to go forward. Can you tell us briefly what it was that the Sixth Circuit said and what the prisoners have done afterwards, especially in light of the fact that the execution of Ronald Phillips is scheduled for next week?
Right. So first, I think it's important to recognize that what the magistrate decision, the magistrate judge's decision, and the panel's decision simply determined that there was enough evidence that the executions would not satisfy the Constitution to have a trial. Okay, so it really is the preliminary process of let's really get into a trial about these facts. Let's find out what's going to happen if we do it this way. And that would then get to the final question of whether or not Ohio's system is in fact constitutional or not. What the en banc majority did was reverse both of those earlier courts' decisions that there was sufficient evidence of this risk of harm to deny the defendants the stay of their execution simply to prove their claim, to get to the point of actually having the full-blown trial, which is how we resolve things in the United States. You know, some countries shoot at each other to resolve conflicts. We don't. We go to court, we have trials, we have judges who make decisions, issue rulings, we appeal, and then you go from there. And we all accept the decision of the courts as being a valid decision because that's how our system is designed. In this case, what the panel's majority, the en banc majority said, is that we just don't think that the inmates have shown enough of a risk. There certainly is a risk that this is not going to go well, but they haven't been able to prove that there's enough of a risk. And one of the reasons for that is sort of this circles back to our earlier discussion about the changes in the protocol. And that's because every time we get to the point of having a trial, the state changes the methods of execution and you have to start all over again.
So now, what do the prisoners do? The first execution is scheduled for the 25th.
Right. I filed a petition with the Supreme Court of the United States asking the Supreme Court to take up the decision of the en banc court and to review that decision. They've asked the Supreme Court for a stay of execution so that the court has time to consider the pleadings and decide if they want to take the case, and then if they want to take it, to then actually reach the merits of the appeal. There are some other ancillary things being litigated, especially for Mr. Phillips, who's scheduled for next week, that are unrelated to some of the lethal injection stuff. But that's where lethal injection is right now in Ohio.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong here. Let's say as a hypothetical that the U.S. Supreme Court says it's not going to hear the case, and it allows some of the executions to go forward. The lethal injection litigation still goes on, though, doesn't it? I mean, it was only at the preliminary stage that they said they're not going to grant a stay. That doesn't mean they're not going to actually go ahead and have an evidentiary hearing, and they might be able to prove that the execution scheme is unconstitutional even after people have already been executed.
Right. And that will happen. Let's assume that they're going to execute Mr. Phillips next week. The details of that execution will become evidence in the ongoing lethal injection litigation. Now, sort of bizarrely enough, one of the problems that inmates face in this type of litigation, of course, is the absence of evidence. The courts consistently come back and say, well, the inmates have been unable to prove that this is not going to go the way the state says. And then, of course, it doesn't go the way the state says, so the state changes the process. Just earlier this week, the magistrate judge in the district court denied the plaintiff's motion, the inmate's motion, to have independent observers watch the executions in order to provide testimony about what happens during the execution. And so here you have the inmates coming in and saying, look, we know we have to provide evidence that things don't go right. You have discounted the evidence offered by former defense counsels who observed the execution because, well, they're death row lawyers. They're always going to say things that help their clients. You've denied the validity of testimony from the inmates' families who observe the executions. In many cases, they've even denied the testimony of the news people who are watching the executions, somehow biased against capital punishment. So here in the Phillips, in this current round of Ohio litigation, the plaintiffs have said, look, we want independent people to watch this execution. And they can then testify about what happened, and you can't say that they have some flaw in their testimony because they're biased. And the district court said, no, I'm not going to allow you to have those people in there.
Well, there you have it. We have 27 executions that are coming up, a very fluid situation and a situation that isn't particularly satisfactory, I don't think, when it comes to the way in which the courts are addressing it and the manner in which people get to death row in the state.
That's true. Yes.
Thank you, Michael. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to Discussions with DPIC. To learn more about Ohio's death penalty process and about the death penalty in general, visit our website at www.deathpenaltyinfo.org to make sure that you receive every episode of our podcast, subscribe on iTunes, or on your podcast app of choice.